Hello there, welcome to The Commentator's Curse. My name's Ian Danter. This is the show that lifts the lid about the weird old world us commentators inhabit. I've been working as a football commentator, mostly, on the radio for about 20-odd years now, and I come across so many lovely people who've got brilliant stories to tell about how they got to where they are and how they've stayed where they are and the myriad of routes that can be utilised to get to where these people are. There's a whole archive of episodes you can check out. The most recent one was with Barry Davis, which has proved to be incredibly popular, as I thought it might, simply because it's Barry. But there are other episodes that are just as entertaining and just as much fun that you can check out in the archive, which started, as I say, about 13, 14 weeks ago with Guy Mowbray and Ian Crocker. So let me bring our two guests in for today's Commentator's Curse. The first is going to be a familiar name to you if you're a regular viewer of Match of the Day, but to say he's merely a Match of the Day commentator is a little bit restrictive because there's so much more work that this chap does. He has worked for TalkSport alongside me on occasions, but he also works an awful lot for what you may have already heard termed the world feed, commentaries that don't get broadcast in the UK but around the world. But he's attended many, many major tournaments in person, and he's just about to go off to attend one particular tournament that's of great interest to all of us who are thinking of going to Qatar next year. John Roder is with us on the Commentator's Curse. Hello, John.
Hello, Ian.
Nice to have you with us, John. And my other guest is a former TalkSport colleague of mine who has spent the last few years as a commentator on ESPN over in the States, and he moved over to the States to facilitate that particular career move. He was a sports editor of a radio station at a very, very tender age, if memory serves me correctly. He'll confirm or deny that furiously as we talk, I presume. He's written some terrific books with the likes of Steve Nichol. Also, he's just contributed to a book about Paul Mariner, the late, great Paul Mariner, that's set for release. But a big Hearts fan. And he's written books on that particular maelstrom as well in the last few years. It's Mark Donaldson on the Commentator's Curse. Mark, how are you?
I'm good, Mr. Danta. How are you?
Well, we're all right, because John and I, it's quite mild here in the UK. I don't know. I know what it gets. It's Connecticut, isn't it, that's your base. I don't know whether it's quite got as taters as it normally gets yet at that time of year. How's it doing over there?
Yeah. We have a wonderful word in Scotland called fresh. When the weather is fresh, it can mean many things. It usually means, so we're a bit chilly. So a Scottish summer's day of about 50 degrees. But I'm looking forward to coming over to the UK after some commentaries this weekend to launch Paul Mariner's book at the start of the week. So I can experience some of your mild weather.
Yeah, we don't get bears over here, though. I mean, you had any bears yet this year?
It's usually three or four times a week. They're smart creatures, by the way. Smarter than your average bear. They come usually on Monday or a Tuesday, because our trash, our garbage, our rubbish gets picked up on a Wednesday. They know. They can smell it. So it's usually, that's
my
bear.
Dog.
It's more angry than the bears we get here. Although I wouldn't want to get too close to them. Goodness.
See, the dog heard the word bear and thought, right, that's it, attack. Protect my human.
I think it was actually the doorbell, to tell you the truth. But there you go. I'd actually forgotten that she was here. So that was the first rule of broadcasting. Completely broken, wasn't it? Make sure there are no distractions in the room.
Never work with children or animals.
I thought for a minute, that. John, you meant that your doorbell sounded like a bark, and that's to scare people away.
No. It's my little dog, and she's actually just come up to make a bit of a fuss. But thankfully, it's a podcast, not a video, so you can't see me glaring daggers at her.
Yeah, sort of grabbing hold of the snout saying, don't you dare do that again, or something like that. There's a couple of things. Before we delve into your respective pasts, the present is very interesting for both of you for very differing reasons. And John, I'll start with you, because you are about to head out to the Middle East for a tournament that precedes the World Cup, which will be underway by this time next year. So you're going to be one of the first commentators to see what the layout and the logistics of being a commentator at this next World Cup is going to be like. Exciting?
It'll be interesting. It'll be my second visit, actually, to Qatar. I was there 2 years ago for the Club World Cup. So I've already worked at the Khalifa International Stadium in Doha. We're going to see a lot more new stadiums over the next 3 weeks or so. It's the FIFA Arab Cup, which is being set up basically as a road test for the World Cup itself next year. It's going to be very, very different for anyone who's been fortunate, as you and I both have, Dan, to go to a World Cup. Qatar's about the size of Yorkshire. I mean, think how many Qatars could fit into Russia and the amount of travelling that we did in Russia back in 2018. So it's going to be literally the same hotel for 3 or 4 weeks next year. It's certainly the same hotel for me for 3 weeks coming up next week. It's a very different place. It's going to be possibly a bit of a culture shock for many when they get there. The stadiums are wonderful. Those that I have been to there, they are wonderful. It's a completely different discussion, of course, as to how those stadiums were built and all the problems and controversy regarding that. But actually, stadium-wise, they are terrific. What is interesting is that in that part of the world, and I've worked in the UAE as well, is that a lot of football watching is done on the television. So it's abroad leagues. You know, the Premier League is very big out there and other leagues like Serie A, et cetera, et cetera. So actually getting home spectators through the gates is actually quite interesting. Whether, obviously, it'll be different next year when the stars of the world are there, whether it'll be difficult this time round with the Arab Cup, or whether it'll be like many tournaments where I go to, where the home nation gets a lot of support and matches involving other countries don't. So, I mean, in South Korea a few years ago, I was in a 40,000-seater stadium and there were two matches that day. The first game, I can't remember who it was between, but there was probably about 600 people in the stadium. And then South Korea were in the second game and there were 35,000 in there. So, you know, it's quite a difference. Tournaments are wonderful things to go to, and I'm a very, very lucky person to be able to do so.
I did hear about one of those stadiums that's been built using shipping containers.
Yes, that is one that I'm actually working at. So I mean, I'm very interested to look at that because apparently it's going to be taken down afterwards.
Yeah, I did hear about that. So you know, it's all held together with bolts, and then as soon as the tournament's done, then
they're going to unbolt it.
Yeah, and it'll be shipping containers. Mark, in terms of your present, there's a lot of interest. Funnily enough, you'd be amazed just how much interest there is back here into how football rights, specifically Premier League, are deployed in the States. And I know, I'm not sure whether a decision's been reached yet, but there's lots of rights up for tender that yourself as ESPN and NBC are up for. So it's that horrible wait, I suppose, at the moment then, is it?
It is. We don't have it, so we hope to get it. So we wouldn't be losing it. We would be gaining it if we get it. Now, I have a subscription to the Times online and been reading Martin Ziegler's pieces in there. He's been dealing a lot with the World Soccer Talk website over here. The guy's a Welsh guy called Chris Harris, who's over here, runs that one. And between the pair of them, they've got a lot of good information about what's going to happen. So currently, NBC are the rights holders. Initially, it appears there were up to 9 different parties that were interested. The interesting thing for us with regards to the Premier League rights coming up, Dance, is that for the first time, they may be split into different packages, which could allow more than one broadcaster to be able to get a rights. I mean, over in the UK, you've got Sky, you've got BT Sport, Amazon have got a piece as well. There's different packages up for grabs. So again, we hear what we hear. Our job as commentators depends on the rights that we had or have. I did Serie A as lead commentator for 3 years. We just lost the rights to CBS in the summer. Now we might be teaming up with CBS for the Premier League rights. So it can be proactive, but a lot of the time it's reactive as far as rights are concerned. And we do what we do and we don't complain much.
We all know that over here, the kind of 4 o'clock Sunday game in the UK is regarded as the most lucrative package. Which one is regarded as top dog when it comes to the American audiences, obviously with a different time zone and all that?
Usually the biggest game that we get over here is the 12:30 on a Saturday. I mean, this weekend it's Liverpool against Arsenal. And NBC, who have the all the rights right now, what they do is we get all the games live over here. So I know there's talk in the UK about Steven Gerrard's return to Anfield not being shown live. That's a story that isn't even a story because the rights and the games have been chosen in advance of that. So The Saturday game is put on NBC, the main channel. It's like putting it on BBC or ITV in the UK. Everybody gets NBC. It's an over-the-air channel. So that's usually the big one. They usually send Arlo White to commentate on that one with Graeme Lasseau and Lee Dixon. And we'll get John or whoever are doing the world feed. Jim Proudfoot usually does the early game, the 7:30 in the morning, which is 12:30 for you guys. But I would say the Saturday one is the big one, because on the Sunday, NFL countdown shows and everything like that. There's a lot of big games that take place on the Sunday, of course. But look, people will watch. If there's a big game on a Sunday or a Saturday early, Leicester-Chelsea this weekend is a big one as well. So people will watch, and the viewing figures over here are huge.
So just to clarify, Mark, that's the Saturday tea time game in the UK, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. We're 5 hours behind on the East Coast, 8 hours behind on the West Coast. And for the West Coast as well, that's 9:30 on a Saturday morning. So everyone's pretty much up to watch that game. The tough ones for the West Coast are the 7:30 in the morning Eastern time, which is 12:30 in the UK, because that's 4:30 in the morning. But they do what's called a fan fest. NBC, their coverage, I have to say, has been absolutely phenomenal since they got the rights. And they take it around the country. And for the first time, they took it to LA, which is tough because, I mean, I imagine that the call for the on-air talent would probably be about midnight or 1 o'clock to get makeup and everything like that done. Although Robbie Musto doesn't require too much makeup, I would suggest. So yeah, it's early for them, but 5 hours to the East Coast. So the 12:30 UK time would be 7:30. I would say that's probably the most popular one, because it's your evening kickoff and the West Coast can watch that too.
Just goes to show different times, different parts of the world, different priorities as to what game takes precedence. And you go to the other side of the world, you go to the Far East, you go to Singapore, Thailand, then
sure,
a completely different game becomes the more convenient and therefore the most watched. Strange stuff. All right, let's go back to beginnings, if we may, gents, because that's kind of what this podcast is all about, finding out about the routes that people took. John, you came to Match of the Day, mid-2000s, I think.
2004, when the rights came back to the BBC, having had 3 years on ITV, I was one of the people taken on in 2004.
So where did you start your broadcasting career, and was it always in the firmament?
I never wanted to be a football commentator. I wanted to be a music journalist. And I wrote about music for my local paper in Hampshire, the Hampshire Chronicle, based in Winchester, which is where I was born and brought up. And I wrote gig reviews and various things and interviewed people, saw all sorts of gigs on the freebie ticket. And I was still at school doing this. This was like the last year at school, 2 years of A-levels. So I interviewed people like Ian Gillan and Gary Newman. I saw the last gig that Bon Scott ever did with AC/DC about 10 days before he sadly passed away. So I saw loads and loads of bands, and I really wanted to be a jock. But I didn't want to be a smashy and nicey jock. I wanted to be more like a cross between John Peel and David Kidd Jensen. Remember the Rhythm Twins on Radio 1 in the evenings? And when I went to university, there was a radio station there. And I suddenly felt at home sitting behind this microphone. I arrived in September 82. By probably 3 weeks later, I had my own show. That Christmas, we had the Christmas ball, and John Peel came along to spin a few discs. And the first proper interview I did using microphones that was broadcast on the college radio station was with John Peel, who was lovely. He treated me as if I was an equal rather than some spotty oik of a student. And the band we had on that night were a band called Frankie Goes to Hollywood, who were unknown at the time. And about 6 months later, they were absolutely massive. From there, I think it's a story that we've heard quite a lot on the pod. I wrote to every single radio station in the country saying, have you got any jobs? And they all wrote back. Well, some of them wrote back and they all said no. But the commercial radio station down the road from where I lived in Portsmouth, Radio Victory, said, yeah, come on in and have a look round. Yeah, great. And halfway through my chat with the program controller, I realized I was being interviewed, which was quite a surreal experience. And at the end of it, he said, would you like to come in after you finished your degree and work for us for the summer? I can't promise you very much money, but can you come in and work for us? Yeah, absolutely. It was a foot through the door. And after about a week there, Grant Coleman, who was the sports editor at Radio Victory in Portsmouth, said, would you like to work on a Saturday to earn a little bit of extra cash? And again, with the emphasis on the word little. So I worked there, and the whole thing was that they were going to get an enlarged transmission area. So instead of Portsmouth and Chichester and all that sort of area, it was going to be the whole of Southern Hampshire. But they became the first ever commercial radio station to lose their franchise under the old IBA. And it was because it was going to include Southampton. There were lots and lots of reasons. But basically, the name Radio Victory is connected with Portsmouth, the ship HMS Victory. So towards the end of that, Grant came to me and said, I've had a letter from British Telecom. They're setting up a new sports unit to do premium rate dial numbers. And they're looking for young people to go up and join. And I've recommended you. And I got a job there. And I was working on Turf Call, which was the racing service, Club Call, and Cricket Call. My first commentary was cricket, not football. It was cricket for Essex Cricket Call at Chelmsford with my friend Paul Newton. And our summariser was Trevor Bailey, the former England opening batsman, who basically knew more about cricket than Paul or I did ever. And he'd forgotten more about cricket, obviously. And that was weird. That was a real introduction into commentary. I then went and got a job as sports editor in Coventry at Mercia Sound. I then moved across to the BBC there, went to Network Radio on attachment in 1992, which was great. Big taste of the big time. You know, I did Radio 5, Radio 4, Radio 1. I worked on the local radio desk under basically the best boss I've ever had, Mike Straw. And then I had to go back after my attachment. And that was heartbreaking because having had a taste of the big time, I didn't suddenly want to go back to covering Nuneaton Borough and Stratford Town, all that sort of thing, with due respect to them, because you've had a taste of the big time. And about a year later, I had an interview for a job on the sports desk at Sky News, and Andy Cairns, the other really good boss that I've ever worked for in my life, because I've only ever had two staff jobs ever. Andy Cairns said, well, I can't give you the job, but how do you fancy a whole summer of freelance work? So I left the BBC and went to Sky. And within about 3 weeks, I was back in at Radio 5, actually reading the sports news because they used freelancers. And that was in April 1994. And I've been freelance ever since. I have no contracts with any of my clients whatsoever. And somehow I've survived and managed to make some sort of so-called career in this mad business of ours.
Just let me quickly go back before I go to Mark of that the cricket call. So for the uninitiated younger listeners, you would dial a premium rate phone number,
yes,
an 898 number, and listen potentially to 8 hours, if you wanted to, of
yes,
the entire session at Chelmsford or wherever it might be.
Yes.
I'm trying to think how much that would cost.
On Turf Call, I was basically the producer stroke production assistant on that one, which was actually really quite interesting. And the lads who were in the studio relaying the racing, because we used to get an audio feed which went to the bookmakers, and we got that. This was in the days before satellite television, etc. And I had to make some jingles for that service, which, you know, for all the latest results, ring the Turf Call results service on 0898 12 11 63 or whatever it was, you know, with all the news. And that went on for about 25 seconds. And that jingle went on for 25 seconds because there was one number on speed dial on the phone in the studio to the bookmakers. So the guys who were presenting would say, "Would you know, give me a signal." And I press the jingle and they press number one on the phone. I'd literally go, "Hi, it's, can I have a 10 quid on Brown Door in the 210 at Haydock?" And they put the phone and go, "Hello, welcome back." It was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. Club Call was great. A load of people came through that, many of whom are working at a very high level. I was there for, 15 months or so, and it taught me an awful lot.
Right.
Grant, I want to follow that up with John, because I remember John gave the number with 63. The Hearts number was 0898 12 11 83, right? So all the clubs had them. But the people involved always seemed to speak really slowly. "Hello and welcome to..." And you're like, "Come on, I'm paying premium money for this. And just get on with it. Coming up, on, I don't care what's coming up. Tell me why I've phoned."
Yeah,
so much.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing was, you'd say, "Hello and welcome to Sheffield Wednesday Club Call. In a moment, we'll be hearing from left-back Fred Bloggs. But first of all, this week's lucky lottery numbers. They are 6, 12, 14. And, the old beaters going round and everything. And about 90 seconds into it, you'd suddenly start to hear from Fred Bloggs. the left back. Yeah, it was good times.
I did club call very briefly. I was just asked to pitch in, be a pinch hitter for dear old Mick Tranter, who asked me to do a bit of Birmingham club call whilst I was working for Capital Gold. I don't remember any specific instructions to talk at 0 miles an hour, but I think you just took it as read that, hang on, there's a reason why, yeah, I've heard this. So, yeah, don't go like a bull at a gate. Yeah, pace yourself, and Trant will be happy with you. But, yeah, halcyon days of club call. And for those who are too young to remember it, honestly, it was nuts. And it was a very, very popular service when you talk about the pre-satellite television, pre-internet age that we're so used to now. Anyway, Mark, let's get to you, because you're a Jambo. You're a big Hearts fan. Are you an Edinburgh boy? Were you born and grew up there?
Yeah, born in Edinburgh, grew up in Penicuik, just south. So, yeah, big Hearts fan since the early 80s.
So, was broadcasting in your mindset the same way it kind of was with John's once he was at uni?
Yeah, but it was news that I kind of began in, because I couldn't get into the sports department at Radio 4. I couldn't get in at all. I wrote a letter saying any chance of some work experience when I was like 15 or 16, got one back saying thanks, but no thanks. It's a general letter, I'm sure, they sent to pretty much everybody. John, I'll have one, you'll have one as well, or many of them. So not to be outdone by that, or not to be kind of sad by that, my dad was a detective inspector in the police. So I thought, okay, I wonder if there's any other ways I can get in. I said, do you know anybody at your work, Dad, that knows anybody at Radio 4? And he goes, yeah, there's the media guy, a guy called Drew Mutter. So I wrote back to David Johnson at Radio 4 and said, my father knows Drew Mutter. He mentioned to drop you a line. Now, David never got the first letter. It was always his secretary. So his secretary probably read this, then probably passed it on to David. And it was like, yeah, come in. And the first day I came in, I think it was 94 or 95 on work experience. And Hearts had just been sold, bizarrely. And I was a big Hearts fan, so I was behind the scenes. So that kind of took me from news to sport. I never really thought I wanted to get into sport, because I never thought I had a chance of doing that. A couple of things. One, my first commentary was Hearts Porto, a pre-season friendly in the mid-90s. It was only my commentary because the commentator I was alongside, the sports editor, forgot his spectacles and couldn't see.
Really?
Yeah, true story. Paul Robertson was his name. He's still involved in the business now doing PR. So I was like, well, sod it. I'll give it a go. And I did. And the other story was background of radio, I'm sure all of us know. They had these bulk erasers. So we used to edit with a razor blade. This sounds crazy to the 20-something millennials or whatever. We used to edit, as you did, Dan. I'm sure John knows about it as well. Used to get a little bit of white tape, and you'd cut the bit out that you didn't want. And you'd edit that way. Health and safety would go nuts about it. But then we had these carts, which were just different lengths of carts. And to clean them, you put them in a bulk eraser. So I cleaned it as normal. And my watch just exploded because of the magnets in the bulk eraser. Yeah. So I'm kind of thinking, this is something different. And it just stuck with me because it wasn't a 9-to-5. So that's kind of how I got started. And if it hadn't been for my friend forgetting his glasses, who knows where I would have been.
Yeah, that's bizarre. Most of the rejection letters I got were from record companies, I have to say, radio stations. So rejection letters, when you're trying to make it as a musician, are almost as funny as the ones you get from radio stations. My band sent one to WEA Records around the time that Appetite for Destruction was the biggest album in the world. And our demo got sent back with most definitely not the standard reply. It said, we created a monster with Guns N' Roses, and we're now paying for it dearly with rubbish like this. This isn't rock and roll. It's dead boring. So this wasn't exactly thank you for your submission. Will we not be considering it? I think we had a good rehearsal that night, though, funnily enough, after that letter.
It actually showed that somebody had listened.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's true.
Rather than a standard, we thank you for your interest and we will place your letter on file. No, it's not on file. It's in the bin.
It is in the bin. maybe they never even opened the jiffy bag that the tape came in. But that's...
I love the fact, Dance, that the three of us have this kind of sport music kind of genre, because John was talking about interviewing Ian Gillan of Deep Purple. I just got an email from Ian Gillan last night, because we're going back and forward about he's written the foreword for Paul Mariner's book because they were best friends. And he's like, I'm coming over to Talk Sport in December. I don't know if you were aware of this, Dance, because he's going to plug his album. He's like, do you want me to mention the book when I'm on? And I can do this and whatever, send a copy. So yeah, so to have him and he, as John, I'm sure, will know having interviewed him, he's just one of the nicest people. I guarantee you, not everyone is like that. And maybe now, because he's a little bit older, he's had his crazy days with Paul and with the band and everybody else. But to have this kind of crossover between, obviously, I've got your albums, Dance. They're just they're on the top shelf.
Yeah, I do. Well, that's best place to keep them. Out of reach.
Just this, there's this football, sport, music kind of crossover between the three of us. It's a big business. It's a big world, the commentary world, but it's a small world as well, is it not?
It is. I mean, you can tie in Talk Sport with the whole Paul Mariner thing because dear old Alan Brazil tells many a story of the Ipswich players going to watch rock gigs at the Ipswich Gaumont in the 80s.
Yep.
Climbing through toilet windows so they didn't have to pay to go and watch Iron Maiden or indeed Ian Gillan when he was doing his solo career.
Wasn't it Terry Butcher who was doing a press conference as the Rangers manager and his phone went off and it was something like the opening bars of Welcome to the Jungle or something like that?
Yeah, he's got that. I mean, he went to see Deep Purple. So Paul was invited to Deep Purple at Nebworth in 84. They'd split up in Japan, I think, at the end of the 70s. This was their first gig back, a horrible rainy day.
That's
so
right.
Mariner's there. He invites, Ian Gillan invites Mariner. So Butcher's there. And Osmond's there as well, because the three of them were as thick as thieves. And one of the tales in the book is Mariner standing by the side of the stage and Terry Butcher and Russell Osmond sitting on top of this big pile of whatever to get a better view. There was £10,000 worth of fireworks there for the closing spectacular show that if they'd gone up, would have taken the entire Nebworth and everyone there out with it. So there was just so many stories of that. They went to see Madness in London and Butcher's leading a conga for baggy trousers. And there's so many tales of music and everything like that. But for Ian to write the foreword and some of the stuff they got up to, just as well, social media wasn't around back in the day because none of them would have had the careers they would have had. They would have probably been behind bars, a lot of them.
Well, yeah, you're dead right. I remember that gig, Nebworth 84. Richie Blackmore played that gig in his wellies. It was that wet that day. The man in black, the mysterious Deep Purple guitarist, playing in a pair of wellies. Anyway, this is a football podcast, so let me quickly... Is it true, Mark, that you were a sports editor by the age of 20 at Radio 4?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the guy who forgot his glasses got promoted to the news editor's job to replace the guy that initially got his secretary to tell me to piss off before I wrote back and said, in you come. Yeah, so he got news ed, I got sports ed's job. And one of the first people I wanted to work with, because he was from Penicuik, where I'm from as well, as the former Rangers captain, a guy called Craig Patterson, who was a Rangers captain, and I think he won the League Cup with them in 84. He played with Hibs, and he played with George Best at Hibs. But I knew him, and I knew I loved the way he thought about football. And that's something, as a commentator as well, we're only as good as the person alongside us, if we're doing that. But for me, I want to try and get the best out of them, and I always thought there was something with Craig. And he didn't really want to do it at first, and he was a nervous Nelly to begin with. But he really blossomed and he ended up working for the BBC. So I kind of take pride in the fact that trying to identify someone that would work alongside you. And what we used to do, and it'll be interesting to get your two take on this as well. We used to do our local team who was playing away from home because we thought we had more chance of an audience because we had the rights. So even though I was a Hearts fan, I'd do Hibs away from home, then Hearts away from home because you've probably got an extra 10, 12,000 worth of an audience there who maybe don't go to the away games. So that's what we did. And I wrote a Hearts book on a Hibs bus in Latvia. And it all started when I was 20 or 21 years old.
Yeah, John, I'm sure will corroborate this. But from my perspective, when it was with Tom Ross working for him at BR&B and Capital Gold, the same principles applied. His catchphrase was, where they go, we go. So he would always prioritise, because we had the BR&B, the FM station in Birmingham, and the AM station was Capital Gold. So he would always prioritise an away fixture for, say, Villa or West Brom or Birmingham over anything else. And that would be the BRMB 3 o'clock Saturday commentary in the days before kickoff times became so splintered, it kind of made everyone's job that much more difficult. But yes, yes, couldn't agree more with you on that, Mark, that the same principles applied. And it did bring in a bigger audience. You could see that there was a worthwhile experiment in doing it that way. The figures bore that out. For your perspective, John, though, a lot of the time you are working Osolomio. You are, you know, for Match of the Day that you do now. Of course, you don't have an analyst alongside you. How much of your work actually involves working with somebody alongside you these days?
It's changed a lot, obviously, because of the pandemic, because used to do quite a lot of co-coms at BT Sport, for example, but now we tend to do only the bigger games there with a co-commentator. It's quite interesting because, obviously, a lot of games I'm on site. Doing a highlights commentary is actually very different to doing a game live to air. We are doing it live. There's still this ridiculous thing that Match of the Day commentary is added on afterwards. Complete poppycock. It really is. We do it live. But it is slightly different. Because if you have a good fact or a good thing that you want to say, you're going to keep it to actually when something happens, when it's going to make the edit kind of thing. So you're not going to say something like, you know, here's Danter who started his career at Birmingham City before a loan spell at Solihull Borough, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You're not going to do it when you have a throw in. You know, that's ridiculous. The good co-commentators, I think, are not necessarily the biggest names. Mm-hmm. In television terms, I think the good co-commentators are frequently those who've worked on radio for a long, long time, because the difference is, I've heard it a lot on this podcast, Dance, on radio, you are everything. Your voice is everything. On TV, if I'm not there, it doesn't really matter because the pictures are still going out. I'm not as important. A commentator is not as important on TV. So I think those who have come through radio, like Tony Gale, like Gary Birtles, Stuart Robson is a particular favourite of mine to work with, Tony DiRigo. They all add things to the commentary rather than just say, great cross, great header, great goal. Well, I can see that. Working with the co-coms is actually a luxury nowadays because I do quite a lot flying solo. And it's just a joy sometimes. If it's a great game, it can absolutely fly along. And if it's a dreadful game, we know that a co-coms can actually help you out hugely.
That's very true. Well, Perry Groves, having been my wingman for some years now on the TalkSport games, quite often. Well, actually, do you know what? In fairness, there've not been that many games where we've needed. It's not been that bad that we've had to lean on each other, shall we say? Yeah, normally, there's enough to keep us entertained. Not least because there's games going on at the same time elsewhere and goals flying in, so that contributes to the commentary. But you mentioned Craig Patterson there, Mark. Mm-hmm. And obviously, there's John talking about the style of somebody like Stuart Robson, who I've always admired, has a real good coaching ethic that he brings to his co-commentary. So I presume that as the weeks went by, Craig got more and more confident and sounded better and better and better on air to sort of validate your decision to bring him in.
Yeah, but you've got to know their strengths as well. Their weaknesses you can work on off air, but you've got to try and accentuate their strengths on air. And as John quite rightly mentioned, I think having a radio background is certainly beneficial because they're telling a story. But you've got to know what they're good at and try and, I mean, Craig was a really good defender. So if there's specific instances of a play happening or whatever, you can get them to explain it. But it's kind of changed so much since then because John's mentioning how he's doing a lot of games either solo and sometimes he does it with a co-com. We started doing work from home, commentaries from home. I've got another one this weekend in the Bundesliga. And I did a Spanish game, not from home, but we're now doing remote commentaries, i.e. even when we went back to do Serie A, and now we have the rights for La Liga and the Bundesliga, during the main crux of the pandemic, we weren't allowed to be in the same booth. We were allowed to be back in the office, but we had to be in separate booths because of social distancing. So there's no real difference between being in separate booths, whether you're in the same corridor, on the same floor at ESPN, or elsewhere. So a few weeks ago, I did a commentary of, I think it was Atletico Madrid, with Diego Forlan. And he was in his house in Montevideo, in Uruguay, which is crazy. I did a commentary with Stuart Robson a few weeks ago, and I love Stuart. He's just so good to work with, and so informative as well. We did a Spanish comms a few weeks ago. He was, I think he was either at IMG or somewhere in London, or Hammersmith or whatever for ESPN. And we did that commentary. So it's a different, hopefully, a string to our bow that we have to learn now. Because when you do a commentary with someone, whether you're with Perry or whether John's with someone else, it's easy if they're sat alongside you, get eye contact, you know when they're going to come in. I don't speak too much during a commentary. That's just my style. I let it breathe a lot, and that allows the person alongside me to come in. But it's easier for them when they're sat beside you.
I take it there weren't any problems with time lag. I mean, Montevideo to the east coast of the United States isn't exactly next door. But, ISDN and everything, we've all had that interview where somebody's been on an ISDN box, but there's a horrible 2-second delay.
Yeah, I've had issues like that as well. We're using a piece of equipment, if we do it from home, called Kisway. So it's a box that plugs in via a USB-C cable. That then brings us onto a website, which we click onto. And usually there's about a lag of about a second. That's the best I think we've managed. When it gets longer than that, it becomes slightly more problematic. I mean, I'm doing Barcelona in a couple of weeks with Luis Garcia. Luis might be in Spain. He might be in England. I don't know where he'll be. It doesn't really matter, but there can be that issue, but you've just got to, it's part of the evolution of commentary in the due to facilities. And it's not a case of, well, how can ESPN not have somewhere where you can broadcast from? We have a corridor, a booth at ESPN, a corridor at ESPN with 8 booths. Normally you can have 8 commentaries in those 8 booths. With those 8 booths, you have 4 what we call PD rooms, production rooms. So production room 11 is A and B. A's in English, B's in Spanish. You've got one game between those two booths and one production room. Now, during the pandemic, we had to have single people in single booths and only one person in the production room at a time. And there's usually 3. So we're only able to manage 2 games in that corridor when we used to be able to manage 8. That's why we're doing stuff from home now. And that's why you're getting things like a lag and whatever. But interesting to get your take on this as well. I never say I'm at a game. If I'm at a game, and I never say I'm not at a game when I'm not at a game, because we did Roma Juventus from Stadio Olimpico, and we're doing the pre-match from the touchline. People can see that we're there. You get to see more when you're at a game, of course you do, but don't tell everyone you're there, because what you're doing is you're telling everyone you're not normally there for every other game. So again, I don't know what you two think about when you're there, when you do games, and when you're not there, and when you don't, if you say you're there.
I think it's interesting, that one, very much so, because definitely don't say that you're there if you're not, and don't say that you're not there. However, I think it's perfectly feasible to say, if you're doing a Serie A game, for example, it's been a sunny day in Rome, temperatures up to 32 degrees, which will make things difficult this afternoon. You know, I don't see anything wrong with that. At FIFA events, we're encouraged to say we're there to try and give some sort of flavour to the event. So, for example, in Sochi at the last World Cup, I did Peru against Australia, which was a dead game, a dead group game, you know, and nothing really mattered on it because neither side could get through. But the night before, thousands of Peruvian supporters descended upon Sochi. They were all wearing the famous iconic Peru shirt. They all had hand luggage only because they'd come in from wherever the previous Peru game. And it was astonishing. It was amazing. It was as if Sochi had been turned into Lima. Now, I only knew that because they basically were all in our hotel, it seemed, you know, everywhere you went. And so you mention it and you say, you know, on our hotel last night, you know, hundreds and hundreds of Peru fans came out. We went out for a drink last night. There were Peru fans everywhere. And that kind of brings you a flavour of the event.
It adds to it, doesn't it?
It adds to it. But the World Cup and tournaments like that are one-off events. If you have a continuing contract, i.e. to do a league, and you do one game on site all season, then I agree with you completely, Mark. There's no point in actually emphasising the fact that you're there or you're not there, because it then reiterates the fact that you're not there for the majority of the time.
I actually get quite annoyed with commentators that say here whilst they're commenting. Mm-hmm. Oh, damn well they're not there. They've got to cut that out of their vocabulary. That I don't know whether that's just a reflex action and they don't even realise that they're saying it here in the Stadio Olimpico. Somebody has got to tell these people, you've stopped doing it, because it's false advertising in one way or another. I'm always personally, Mark, very, very careful to make sure that I don't go down that particular road. In fact, since the pandemic, whenever TalkSport has done a commentary off tube, we've always been at pains. In fact, it's been recommended, look, just say twice a half, we're watching this from our London studios.
That's interesting, because that's changed. I did Scotland against France from my living room in Edinburgh in my shorts and T-shirt. And I never said, this was when McFadden scored the goal, and I wasn't doing it live, but I was doing updates, and I was never told, don't say that you're not there, because that was back in the day when even I think Archie McPherson on Eurosport used to do it from Paris hotel rooms. Things have changed a bit since then, have they not?
They certainly have. Well, look, let's talk a bit about TalkSport, Mark, because you worked alongside me as our Scottish correspondent prior to your move to the United States. Now, of course, TalkSport's relationship with Scottish football is a little bit stronger now. Like we've got, mm-hmm, you know, yeah, Rangers and Celtic commentaries in the Europa League and whatnot. So how did you feel that Scottish football was represented during your time when you were our correspondent?
It wasn't Scottish football, it was Rangers and Celtic. And I was delivering Rangers and Celtic news to the audience when asked to do so, which as a Hearts fan, I get. I'm one of these people who want Scottish teams to do. I want British teams to do. I just think it's better to watch. If you've got a Scottish or an English or an Irish team in European competition, it's just more enjoyable to watch. I don't want Rangers or Celtic to lose in European competition. But I think back then, I don't know if they knew their audience fully. I think that it was very London-centric. When I was there, and now we can go north of the border. Well, is that north of the London border to Watford, or is it further up and going into Scotland? I did it since 2007 because I was at Talk 107, which was the sister station. That's how you and I got to know each other, having left Radio 4 back in 2007. So, yeah, I mean, we did a lot of games. We did all the Scotland games. We did Rangers and Celtic in Europe. I even did the election show overnight during a general election in 2009 or whatever. But I just loved the fact it was so not BBC in that, nothing against the BBC. BBC is the quality it's to which we all kind of aspire, and everything is kind of used to be taken care of people that, because I did many games where the BBC guys were there as well. They had an engineer with them, they had a producer with them or whatever. We're just rocking up with this huge big, was it a Comrex kit that we used to have that weighed about God knows how big? And it was a nightmare. We'd have to plug it in. We'd have to ask favors. And if we did European games away from home, we'd have to bribe the locals with 10 bucks or some beer to plug it in and set up the ISDN kit. That's why I think local radio, we learned more by doing something like that. And I love the stuff that I did for TalkSport.
Well, I got to meet you a few times. Alan Brazil, I remember Alan Brazil doing a tour of Scotland, doing the breakfast show one week with Ronnie Irani. And I was, for some reason, I was detailed to go with them to do Fox Pops. You know, I think we did something at the Clyde. Oh, God, my head still pounds. That week, and how long? That's over a decade ago now.
Mm-hmm. What, did you do Fox Pops, or were you the minder?
Well, I don't know. I think, John, why it was I was sent up there. It wasn't exactly for colour, because we're on air between 6 and 10 in the morning. It was flipping dark outside. There was nothing to get a Vox.
I know exactly why you were sent up there, Dance, because you were in your usual position of being on the subs bench.
This is true.
So super sub Danter.
Nail on head. Alan suddenly went AWOL, as has happened, and it's still the world record. Nobody will ever beat being woken up at 5:57 a.m. to cover a 6 o'clock Alan Brazil sports breakfast shift, as I was. That's probably true. I was ballast, really, wasn't I? As much as anything.
Yeah. We had a couple. You were up in Edinburgh doing the breakfast show or being part of the breakfast show. We did it at a hotel on George Street in Edinburgh. That was one of them. We did Paddy Power came up. He was sponsoring something. So he, opposite the railway station, the Waverley station, we did another thing there. But one of my favorite memories, I don't think you were there. It was Scotland, Italy. If we won, we went to the World Cup. So Brazil came up. We did the game. Brazil went for lunch in Rogano in Glasgow with Rod Stewart.
As you do.
The game was a 5 p.m. kickoff on a Saturday. We'd been doing the breakfast show on the Thursday and the Friday. Our hotel was in George Square in Glasgow, and in each room there was a decanter. One had brandy, one had whiskey, and one had gin, and they were refillable for no cost. This was in Brazil's room. I'll let you imagine what happened. Well, it has to be. It has to be. Anyway, it's 2 o'clock. We've arranged to get a cab. There was a few of the TalkSport producers and production guys and girls behind the scenes. So we were all going to go in a cab with Alan Brazil at 2 o'clock. 2 o'clock came and went. Of course it did. 2:30 came and went. 3 o'clock came and went. We're starting to panic. Then 3:45, we're like, whoa, traffic and everything like that. So eventually we made contact with them because we couldn't get near them in Rogano or whatever because there was a posse and he was up the back. We eventually got him in a cab. And there's a famous clip of Alan Brazil singing Flower of Scotland prior to that game that talks about it's been on Clips of the Week. It's, and if you could manage to get that, I'm sure between us we could find it.
Oh, Adrian Durham, listen to it.
Brazil, sing then. Come on.
I'm singing, don't worry.
Well, sing into the mic. Come on, I want to hear you.
Flower of Scotland. Go on, you two. Adrian, we're going to the Alps, don't worry. I'm sending you a postcard.
Alan had enjoyed his lunch with Rod Stewart. I was detailed, to babysit Alan Brazil, which was difficult, I have to say. And it would be remiss of me to suggest that Alan did or did not complete the 90 minutes in attendance at Hampden that day. But let's just say the final report that I did, which was meant to be Alan and myself, I think was only me. And there was a good reason for that because Alan, I don't think, was with me at the time. He was later found back in Rogano at a later hour of the evening in Glasgow. So the babysitting went okay up to a point. I got him there. I got him singing. I got him on air. I don't think we did the full-time report together.
The anthem was ongoing, and Adrian Durham, who was hosting back in London, said, come on, I'll sing. And
yes.
And he duly obliged in the way that only a half-cut Alan Brazil, I say half-cut, the way Alan Brazil can at that point. Everyone's got Alan Brazil stories. I don't know whether you have, John, because, of course, you've worked for TalkSport at tournaments. You've done commentaries for us, but I don't know whether you've ever been Brazil the way that me and Mark have.
No. I mean, I did Euro 2012 for TalkSport. There was me and John Norman was our producer in Poland, and I was with Richard Keys and Andy Gray, who hadn't long departed Sky. Now, listeners might not know this, but in radio, I think we could all agree, in radio, you bring your own equipment to broadcast from. In television, there's lots of people to do it for you. You just have to turn up. So we have this massive suitcase, and we have to park about 3/4 mile from the stadiums. And me and John Norman, bless him, we used to pull this great big suitcase along, and Richard and Andy would sort of stride along in front. And about 2 weeks into the tournament, one of them, I can't remember which, sort of said, oh, I'll pull that. And then suddenly you realise that they suddenly knew that they were in radio again and not in TV La La Land where people bring you your drinks on a velvet cushion emblazoned with a gold tassels and things like that. It was great fun. Great fun doing radio.
Wait a minute. For how long did either Richard or Andrew Gray happily pull that suitcase, and how long before they handed it back to you or John Norman? Oh, come on. How often did they muck in?
They mucked in when it came to buying the drinks, which was good. So that was absolutely fine. In terms of pulling the case, probably just a few times, kind of thing like that.
That's an absolute disgrace.
Yeah. I have to say, though, that doing that tournament for TalkSport was great fun. I think if you ask any television commentator, any commentator who works primarily in television now and who did work in radio, whether they prefer television or radio, I think probably 90% would say radio. Because you can go off on different tangents. You can, if it's boring or something, you know, you can just go on about whatever. Obviously, the match is the central point of your commentary. And I miss it. I must admit, I really miss it. I loved doing that tournament for TalkSport and a few games afterwards. Sadly, it wasn't to continue, but that's just the way of the world. And as a freelance of many years standing, that is just the way of the world. As Mark said, you kind of bounce from contract to contract. I remember back in 2002, I had about 8 or 9 regular deals with people who were basically I'd work for ITV Regional, the ITV Sport Channel. I worked for ESPN Star in Asia. I did the Mezzanotte games, which are on Channel 4, the Italian middle-of-the-night games. I did various other things. I've had about 8 or 9 regular contracts. Not contracts, but handshake deals. And I lost all of them that summer. Every single one of them, the rights came to an end. And as a freelance, that's just the way you have to go. Just jump from job to job.
Yeah, look, everyone should realise, you know, people are trying to get into the industry. It's not all champagne and roses. There are moments of severe self-doubt. There are moments when you do wonder whether another contract is ever going to fall into, or a deal, as you say, John, is going to somehow transpire itself. It's funny, mind you, it's funny you talk about suitcases and Andy Gray and Richard Keys attempting to drag a suitcase. We had in the 2018 World Cup in Russia, we had a similar suitcase, which ostensibly was meant to have 2 wheels on the bottom of it to pull along. And Declan, our producer, soon discovered about a game into the tournament that one of the wheels was faulty. So he's basically, it's like dragging a lifeless corpse for these exclusion zones that were a good 2 miles outside the stadium to get anywhere near like the Rostov Arena or Sochi.
The wheels on the case don't go round and round, round and round.
Matt Holland was quite happy to muck in and pull that case for as long as required. But actually, Deccan was quite a proud man and wouldn't have anybody else do it. But there we are. That's another thing. Mark, let's get to the move to the United States, because where did the connection come for you to cross the Atlantic?
Well, I got kicked out of Talk Sport after doing the Great North Run with Jason Cundy, Peter Beardsley, Mike Parry, and Ian Danter, and not identifying Paula Radcliffe correctly. So I got escorted out of the country. I know this is an audio-only podcast, but I want to show this to John right now. This is a beautiful picture of the lot of us. And Mike Parry showed up wearing running gear to try and take part in the Great North Run, which was never going to happen. Dance and I look like we've had a good life, but it was still in its infancy.
I'd driven up from Southampton the previous night, all the way up to Newcastle. For that broadcast, I had a gig at the firehouse in Southampton and the night before, and driven through the night on 2 cans of, you know, whatever that sort of...
Tenant special brew.
That's it. Yeah, no, but forget your Red Bull. So I got all the way to the hotel at about 6 in the morning. Had 2 hours sleep, and then met you at the at our rendezvous point. I'm sure you're joshing that you got kicked out. Surely,
of course.
But obviously, you felt that the pastures knew. Was something already in the offing then, or what?
Yeah, working with Cundy and Beardsley and Danter was the pinnacle to that point of my broadcasting career. It was around that time, I think it was that summer, I was over in the States visiting my cousin in New Jersey, and Derek Ray was over here. Now, Derek decided, probably about 2008, 2009, where he was doing Scottish football for either Satan, I think it must have been ESPN, UK, who had the rights to it. But Derek, who lived over here, would fly over every Thursday and fly back after the game, usually on a Sunday. He'd do a transatlantic flight just to cover Scottish football. And he thought this would be a good idea. It lasted a year, and he quickly realized that his health, as everything else, wasn't going to continue if that was the case. So we had a chat, and he said, look, I'm thinking about maybe flying over to the UK and living over in London, so my job might be up for grabs. And there was also another posting. So he said, look, if it's something you fancy, let me know and I can put you in touch with them. So I did, and it took about a year, and I was over again in the States. I just proposed to my missus in Central Park on the 4th of June, and the call came through on the 5th saying, any chance you could fly over to do a demo tape for us. And I was in Jersey, said I can drive up tomorrow if you want. And I did, and I can't remember what the game was. I know my first ever game was Trezena against Milan. We say Milan now, it's AC Milan, whatever it is, with Janis Mihalić in the October. But yeah, I did the demo in the June. And the weird thing is, and this is where all the worlds collide, it was July 27th, 2010. I'm in London, and it's 20 minutes before 8 o'clock. Danny Kelly had invited me to do an 8 till 10 slot with him on TalkSport Evening. And the call came from one of the producers saying, you'll be getting a phone call on Monday. I think this was a Friday, Thursday or Friday night. You'll be getting a phone call on the Monday offering you the job. I've still got the rundown for that TalkSport show with Danny. And I'm glad I do, because my memory of that is, my head was up my backside, because it's a life changer. Just with everything. So it was in TalkSport. It had to be in TalkSport, didn't it? And I was in the old building at Hatfield in the cafeteria, just waiting to go on air, having a cup of coffee, and the phone went and said, yeah, you've got the job at ESPN. You'll get a confirmation call on Monday. So that was that.
Well, it's a good job you're working with Danny, because, you know, he'd have done most of the talk anyway for those 2 hours. Let me tell you that, for anybody listening to this who thinks I'm being unnecessarily sarcastic, Danny would be the first in line to say that about that. Well, yeah. So, whatever you were talking about, it was all a blur.
It is interesting, Dance, that that in this mad world that we inhabit, that a phone call or something like that can change your career, your so-called career. I'll take you back to 1997, and I was freelancing for a lot of different people. I was doing the Radio 1 breakfast show at the time, and Radio 5, and I was doing roundups on Sky. And a producer at Sky left to go to ITV Meridian in Southampton, and he said, "Oh, you're from around there. Would you like to come in and do the roundups that night on the League Cup show?" So, yeah. So I went down, and I'm having a cup of tea with my dad, God bless him, at about 6:10, and my mobile rings, and it's the producer on the other end of the phone. He said, "Where are you?" I said, "Well, I'm at my dad's house. I'll be in for about 7:15. And he said, "No, you won't. Can you go to Fratton Park now?" The person who we booked to do the commentary on Portsmouth against Peterborough in the League Cup hadn't told them that he was on jury service, I think it was. And the court case had gone on, and he wasn't going to be able to make it. So I drove from my dad's house in Winchester to Fratton Park rather quickly. I knew pretty much no background to this game at all. It was for highlights. I did it. And the next day I got a call saying, "Great, well done. Thank you very much. How are you sorted to doing the next round?" And this other guy was never used again. And that's just the way it goes in this life. And from working in ITV Regional, you then go to work onto the ITV Sports Channel and so on and so forth. It wasn't my first TV commentary, but it was the most significant one. And it all started with a phone call 1 hour and 35 minutes before kickoff.
Well, it's not just a phone call, John, as well. It's a phone call, but then it's an agreement and an acceptance to be able to actually do something. Because we've all had phone calls, and this is why I find what you do in a freelance business, and for you to be as successful as you've been for as long as you've been, is testament. Because when I was doing the freelance stuff, I found time management the hardest thing, because you want to say yes to everything, but it gets to a point where your family are like, "We're not seeing you. Your health is suffering." And you're just frightened that if you say no, then you'll never get that call again. Like that guy never got the call again, because you came in and did a good job for him.
I think the freelance life, as a freelance sports reporter, sports commentator, is only for a few. I think there are a lot of people who like the security of having a job, if you like. It's not a 9-to-5 job. It never is a 9-to-5 job, but they like the security of having a salary at the end of the day. Now, increasingly, this industry is going towards being freelance. So when I went freelance, there were probably about 3, 4, 5 other freelancers who were working on a national broadcasting basis. Now there are loads. But yeah, you're right. You've got to have this sort of adaptable mindset. And you also, as you quite rightly say, Mark, you have to have a very supportive family who say, "Yeah, you're going to disappear for 3 weeks. Yes, that's absolutely fine. or I'm never going to see you on a Saturday. I mean, people say to me, oh, you know, what did you watch Strictly on Saturday? I say, I haven't seen Saturday evening television for about 23 years, you know. And they have to be prepared for you to be away from home and work on sociable hours and things like that. So you have to have a loving and adaptable family. And fortunately, I have that. But freelancing isn't for everybody, it has to be said.
Mm. To tie a bow dance on the Danny Kelly stuff, and Danny's just such a lovely, lovely guy now living in Ireland. He appears in the book because My Sporting Life, that really enjoyable series on TalkSport where they speak to people who've been in the industry, Paul Mariner had been on there, and it's no longer available online, so I had to get one of the producers to send it to me. But there was a good story, and it's in Paul Mariner's book, about when he went back to Ipswich for the first time. Roy Keane was manager. I think he was at Plymouth. And Roy Keane fell out with him afterwards and came out and said, it's an absolute disgrace. He didn't have time for me or whatever. He sent his backroom staff there because he had so many people that he hadn't seen for so long that he was going to go and see Roy Keane but didn't have time. But at the end of the game, he went over to the Plymouth supporters, took off his jacket and handed it to a girl who was in the front row, who was looking up at him, a Plymouth Argyle supporter. And then it wasn't until he eventually got back into the dressing room, he realised he's looking at his, where's my specs? He paid 500 quid for a pair of specs. Obviously, Mariner wouldn't just go down to Specsavers and get something with a 1.75 varifocal or whatever. He had these posh specs that he put in his thing and given it away. I can't believe it. So what he did, I don't know who was on duty at Portman Road that day, but Danny Kelly was back at Talk Sport. And whoever had done that had interviewed Paul, and he said, look, it's great for radio because I can see you up close because you've got to stand close to the interviewer for radio. He said, I'm going to struggle to do any other interviews. He said, how? So he told the story about the glasses being given away in the thing. So Danny's like, right, for anybody leaving the game, going home, getting back into the cars or getting into your buses, I need you to do me a favor. If you were the girl or you know the girl or the family who's got this Paul Mariner jacket, it contains his glasses, and he needs them back, please. Within an hour of Danny Kelly going on TalkSport and saying that, Paul, before he'd left Portman Road to go back to Home Park in Plymouth, had his jacket and his glasses back. God bless you, Danny Kelly.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's the power of radio, as you rightly say, Mark, at times like that. Extraordinary stuff. John, Match of the Day is a regular haunt for you now. Have you ever been first on Match
of the
Day? Oh, you have?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, 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 absolutely.
When was the last time you were first, if that's not too weird a question?
You could have phrased it better. To be honest, I don't remember. There must have been a time last season. No, I do have a reputation of Gary saying, our final game comes from XX Stadium. Your commentator is John Roder. There is actually a very good blog that's available on the internet, if you can find it. It's by a guy called Mike Worley, which is actually spelt W-H-A-L-L-E-Y. And it's a blog called Last On Match of the Day. And he did it for about 6 years, between about 2006 and 2011, something like that. And I frequently did the last game. I mean, my very first Match of the Day was on the first day of the season in August 2004. I'd been phoned up that summer while I was on holiday in Italy and asked to join their team. It took about a nanosecond to say, yes, please. And it was Blackburn Rovers against West Bromwich Albion. Myself and Tony Jones, my good friend, was there for Sky, for Football First. And my first game was last in the running order. It was 1-1. And I just seem to have had a reputation for a lot of games being last. And I think there's a reason for that. Myself, Martin Fisher, Alistair Mann, we very rarely do Liverpool, Manchester United, Manchester City, now Chelsea, Tottenham, things like that. We very rarely do them. So, you know, if there's a draw between Wigan and Norwich 1-1, it's probably going to be last in the running order. Although mentioning Norwich, I went to Carrow Road yonks and yonks ago, must have been about 2004, 2005, to do Norwich against Middlesbrough. And the local radio reporter for Radio Norfolk, Roy Waller, who's no longer with us, lovely man. He was a legend in Norfolk. Roy said, would you come and have a spot of lunch with me beforehand? I went, yeah, that'd be great. There was a catch. The lunch was with Roy and about 300 other people in the sponsors lounge. And you don't get to get a free lunch. You have to sing for your supper, because Roy was the master of ceremonies. So he'd actually tricked me there. So I had to do a sort of chat in front of these 300 people. And he said, you know, what about the running order? You know, and I said, well, who knows? There is a provisional running order. There always is a provisional running order, but that can get ripped up. I said, who knows? Norwich against Middlesbrough could be the top game tonight. And everyone sort of fell off their chairs laughing. Middlesbrough were 4-1 up with about 8 minutes to go. Norwich came back and drew 4-4. It was an exceptional finish. Absolutely amazing. And it was the league game that night. I've definitely been first. You do get paid the same, whether it's first or last. And as a freelance, that's one of the main things that has to be said. I have to say, though, it is an absolute honour to be on Match of the Day. If you think about it, it's an iconic programme. To have done one game for Match of the Day would have been absolutely magnificent. I've been with them now since 2004, so that's, what, 17 seasons or something like that. So must be doing something right. The day will come when they say, thanks very much, but cheerio. And when it comes, it will come. But I've had a blooming long run on the programme, and hopefully it will continue for some time soon.
Yeah, well, absolutely. 17 years, that's about the same length of time that I've been a Talk Sport employee.
You're never an employee.
Well,
you're never an employee. Come on, Dance. Well, if you're freelance.
I feel like one, having been there for such a long time. And I've not always had a contract whilst I've been there. A lot of times, as you say, it's been a handshake. But in more recent times, I have been offered, you know, a contract for the work that I do, which obviously provides that little bit of security so that you know that something's mapped out for the next year or 2 years. That always, you know, fills you with that, just that little bit of, okay, so now we can build things around that. And of course, from that comes work on other sports like cricket and darts. And it's about to get, you know, it's starting to feel a lot like Christmas because the Darts World Championship is on the horizon. So I'll be dividing my time as a commentator between the fixture program over Christmas, both Premier League and the EFL, with the darts at Ali Pally. So it'll be mind-bogglingly amazing as always. What's Christmas like for you back in Connecticut, Mark? I mean, you know, obviously Christmas must either look magical or a complete pain in the backside.
We call it the Netflix months, because you start watching Netflix usually end of November, and by the time you finish in March, the snow's usually gone. It's cold. But what they do, if it gets this is quite funny, if it gets above 8 inches of snow, which it frequently does, then they put us in a hotel. 7 inches, usually, depends on when it falls, you're struggling. But if it's usually 8 inches is the magic number. Oh, we'll put you in a hotel beside ESPN, because you've got that 6 o'clock game in the morning between Sociedad and Elche. So we don't want you driving from your house. We'll put you up next door. But it is what it is. I mean, it's a beautiful part. I mean, this time of year right now, your autumn, our fall, is phenomenal. Just got back from Houston and Atlanta, doing the World Series baseball, caps off for BT Sport, which is great. And quick story about that one. Former producer came to me one day and said, do you know anyone young, British and good looking that can that would be pretty good for a baseball show? I said, well, I don't tick any of those boxes, but I've got a bit of baseball knowledge. So I ended up, after much persuasion, doing about 5 or 6 screen tests and getting the job. So yeah, we've done that for 3 years now. So that was kind of great. But even in Atlanta, it was cold, but nothing like a Connecticut winter. We'll wait to find out if we've got the Premier League for next year. In the meantime, we've got the German games, Bundesliga 1 and 2. We've got the Spanish games. And the tennis restarts. We'll be doing the Australian Open in January. And then hopefully, like everybody last year, I'm sure we all had wonderful plans lined up. 2019 was Yankees Red Sox at the London Stadium. 2020 was going to be Cubs Cardinals. We did all the intros and interviews at spring training in Florida and Arizona for the second one in London. And then the pandemic hit. I was going to be doing 5 different cities in the Euros, doing all sorts of things. But you know what? We all got affected by that. So it's not a woe be me or or anything. Everyone's got their story. It didn't kind of discriminate the pandemic. Everyone got hit hard by it. And that's when I think the freelancers who've been able to come out of that, not so much unscathed, but still punching, are to be extremely commended, because that must have been the hardest thing, not knowing if you're going to be back at games or doing what. We've all just had to adapt since then.
What other sports have you turned your hand to, John, other than football? Because there's Mark saying, you know, tennis and baseball have been part of his remit.
I did a lot of cricket up to and about 2002. I did a lot of work for what is now Five Live Sports Extra, both on football and on cricket. So cricket was great because I'd grown up on cricket. My dad was an excellent local cricketer. I learned how to count really by learning how to score cricket. So I was the scorer for the team. So I did a lot of cricket. I also was the on-pitch host at Warwickshire, Edgbaston, for about 10 years, from about 91 to 2001, the golden era.
My dad probably sat in the members' seats watching. Yeah. Get him off, get the cricket on.
Well, we did stuff during the tea interval. We had daft things like mascot races and all sorts of different mad things. And it was great fun. But then your old station, BRMB, came along to sponsor the Sunday afternoon games. And obviously, they didn't want somebody who was quite closely associated with the opposition doing that, which led to a DJ doing it, who didn't really know too much about cricket. And we used to do the toss over the public address system, which is, you know, fairly commonplace nowadays, but we were the first to do it at Edgbaston. And I'm told that this DJ, after the Warwickshire captain had won, had correctly called the coin sort of four times in a row, sort of said, "Oh, you're a very good tosser, aren't you?" And this goes out over the PA system, and you kind of think, yeah, you need to know a little bit about cricket. I mean, I think it's very useful to do other sports. I haven't done anything other than football for years, but what I do is I have a deal to do some hours on a sports journalism course at a nearby university, Plymouth Marjon University in the Southwest. And so I do a lot of teaching, probably the equivalent of 4 or 5 hours a week, but not on a regular basis. I just do little blocks of it. And teaching people how to broadcast, teaching people how to use a microphone, how to talk confidently. It actually means that you break down what you do yourself and you re-examine what you do yourself. Because so much of what we do nowadays, as three gentlemen of, shall we say, advancing years, and I'm certainly the more advanced than either of you two gentlemen, but you tend to do things naturally and automatically now. You don't examine the reasons why. But teaching students means that I have to go back and actually think about what I do and why I do it. And that is really, really interesting. And it's actually caused me to re-examine certain aspects of what I do during a football match.
Yeah, well, I've had that, going to give lectures at universities, University of Gloucester, somewhere where I've spoken to students more than once. Does that ever happen to you, Mark, over in the States? Have you had any cause to get involved in that sort of thing?
I've done a few educational things. My sister is now a lecturer at De Montfort University in fashion buying, because she worked for Next at Enderby. So she's been down in England since she was like 18 or 19. And she's gone to, she had three kids. And after the third one, she thought, "I'm going to take time off to spend time with my third child." And then when she went back, she just said, "I want to give something back that I have learned." So she's, they just had their graduation this week, and there's a lot of her class that have done very well. So as a result of that, she's been asked to do some BBC local radio things as well. And she called me up. She goes, "You got any advice for that?" And I said, "Well, you stand up in front of kids every day. That's something I kind of would have used to find difficult, because our commentaries, who knows how many they're going out to, but none of them are looking at us. They don't see who we are or whatever when we're in the commentary booth. And it's not until you're in a room full of people, it's very different." And for her, that wasn't an issue. Her issue was to go on the radio, not even on TV, but to go on the radio and kind of just do a 10-minute interview. So it's interesting, the whole education to journalism. I think looking at the way journalism is now, certainly in this country, there's a lot of really talented up-and-comers that want to get involved in the industry. But I just hope, you were talking earlier about seeing someone saying "here." I think the quality control is an issue. And there's a lot of people who have got a lot of good traits, but they don't have someone that can help them get to the next level. A couple of points over here. This is a very statistically driven country, especially in sport, whether it's baseball or NFL. And there's a lot of them, the American commentators in soccer and football, that think, like we all do, we prep a lot for each game that we do, but they think they have to get everything in to their commentary. And as you were talking about earlier, or John was talking about earlier, talking about his past when he's taking a throw-in, he's just like, come on, you've got to know when to do that. I'd just love to be in a position, not as much as a quality controller, but just as a guider of someone. And there's a lot of people as well who do both. And this isn't just in America. This is in the United Kingdom as well. They spend their midweek doing radio commentaries. Then they do TV again at the weekend. Now, that's fine because we all have a background in both. But it annoys me as a viewer, and I get frustrated when I see a TV commentator who's done a game in midweek or whatever, say, and he's cutting inside or she's cutting inside on the right foot, left foot shot. It's difficult. We have to take what we learn from our different sports, but you can't take too much on. And I think you've just got to be careful with that. But you know what? They'll keep doing that. And it's not their fault if no one tells them, just, this is what we want from you. It's the next level that I think is the problem. And I think there's something there for people that can help others to get where they want to be rather than just quantity over quality. That's a frustration of
that. I couldn't agree more. Just that little bit of guidance, as John does, mm-hmm. students, just, and yep. for everybody, whether you've been in the business 5 minutes, 5 years, or 15 years, just that occasional moment where somebody takes you to one side and says, mm-hmm. okay, just a couple of things here. And it's manna from heaven to me, because it's a way to recalibrate. It's a way to
get better.
Yeah, exactly. So reset yourself and whatnot.
It's my bugbear, actually, Dance. Commentators on the TV who talk too much. Mm-hmm. Commentators on the TV who are all pally-pally with their co-coms and are kind of excluding the viewer. And my other one is people who have done their research and are damn well sure that you're going to hear it. You know, exactly. So we are going to hear everything that you've researched. I go on the premise that 95% of what I research is going to be not used. And if it is used, I have an actual ideal viewer in mind, and it's my late lamented dad. If my dad would find it interesting, it would go to air. If he would find it boring, it doesn't. Now, I don't need to know that Fred Bloggs has scored 13 goals in 122 appearances for his club. If Fred Bloggs has never scored for his club, now that's interesting, particularly if he scores. You know, and all these little statistics and things, I mean, as Mark will know, the MLS stat packs are something to behold. They are an encyclopedia of things, and it literally tells you somebody's inside leg measurement. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, I've got my notes here for the Ligue 1 game that I'm doing at the weekend. And if I just pick any player at random, I'll pick here Timothy Pembele, French under-20 international, 19 years old, on a season's loan from PSG, played at the Olympic Games this year, scored on Bordeaux debut in 2-2 draw at Marseille, played in every Ligue 1 match since joining, 8 starts and 4 subs. That's all I need to know. Whether I use any of that, who knows? But I shouldn't use it because I've got it.
No, but there will come a point in the game where one of those things you've written down will suddenly become pertinent to the commentary, then and only then, rather than...
Yes.
A lot of the time, Dance, the daft stuff that happens in a game that's very unexpected, there's a decent chance we're not going to have that. When was the last time Harry Kane scored back-to-back first-half hat-tricks, right? You're not going to have that after before the first game, right? You probably should have it, or you'll have someone that knows it after the first hat-trick. But going into that, when it's happened, there's usually someone or some people that you can get in touch with. So on our phones, we have an app called Slack. And it's set up for various stats and information groups at ESPN. And they have a whole host. So every game that we do, they have a distinct folder for that. So we've obviously done our own prep for that. They'll continue to put content in that throughout the game. Not necessarily to be used on air, but to help the commentator if it's something they find pertinent at a pertinent point. And they have little icons that go with that. And if we are to mention one of their little stats that they've come up with, there's a little TV icon. And that means that it's been read out on air. So usually, if you can get one or two of them, because they're really, really good stuff. And they don't just give you the age and whatever, because we've all got that. These are the fantastic little nuggets that would enhance a broadcast, as John was talking about. Usually, if you get one of them, you don't have to put any, but you usually find that one of them is useful on air. That's pretty good. But there, as John has mentioned, and as I said about those that do all their prep, there's those that kind of want every single thing that the stat and information group have come up with, and they include that in the commentary. And you know what? It wouldn't surprise me if by doing that, some people actually miss key moments of the game.
There's something going on in front of you all the time, well, pretty much all the time. I'll be going to QPR tomorrow night. And there's, we all live in fear, don't we, of having our head down on a piece of paper at entirely the wrong moment where something spectacular happened.
I must tell you a story about that. Actually, it was at QPR. It was years and years ago. QPR Sunderland the other week, incidentally, in the League Cup. Horrendous. Couldn't see any numbers. Absolutely dreadful from both sides. We were there, yes. Absolutely appalling. I'm at QPR for Radio 5. It's long, long time ago. It must have been 94, something like that. So it was just before ISDN was introduced. And we had these old-style boxes called Kubi boxes, and they had a little handle on them that you used to wind to send a signal down the line to alert the studio in Broadcasting House that something had happened. It was like something out of Dad's Army, you know, call them up, Pike, all this sort of thing. So anyway, there's a goal. My Kubi equipment, it's in a small suitcase, it's under the desk, okay? So I lean under the desk, wind the handle, I'm under the desk. Yeah. Goal here at Loftus Road. Yeah. So I come back up from under the desk and they cross to me and I go, yes, it's goal here. It's Queen's Park Rangers 1, Ipswich 0. Fred Bloggs with the goal. Lovely shot from the edge of the area. Due reward for Rangers play so far. Queen's Park Rangers 1, Ipswich 0. And this fella taps me on the back and says, it was disallowed. While my head was under the bench, it was disallowed. Mm-hmm. So if I'm ever doing anything that involves just reports, whether it's for final score or whatever, I'll always just wait 10 seconds just to make sure that it is a goal. Because we can all miss and make errors like that. The other big error I made was one of my very first TV commentaries. Got a call to do a beanback game. It was Coventry against Newcastle, and it was being beamed back to places in the northeast under the brewery sponsorship that Newcastle had. And I went to the ground and I walked up the ladder to the gantry. Here I come up the ladder and there's two cameras there and two guys with their backs to me. And I said, hello, chaps. I'm John. I'm your commentator for tonight. And two policemen turned around and said, I think you've got the wrong gantry. This is the crowd observance gantry. So we all make errors.
Well, I think one of the most dangerous ones, Dance, is when you get a replay of something and it's, oh, it's like a carbon copy of the first goal. You're like, yeah, it's because it is the first goal, idiot.
The cricket commentators always get caught out with that. You'll notice in the test matches or even a T20, I feel for the cricket commentators who suddenly think they've seen another wicket, but it's a montage that somebody's put together. Listen, we're running desperately short of time, but we've talked for well over an hour, chaps. It's been really fascinating chatting with you both. John, I wish you well in Qatar for your three-week jaunt, and I hope you come back with plenty of good, positive stuff to let us all know about what we're likely to encounter in a year's time. Are you doing a match of the day this weekend before you leave?
No, I have Queen's Park Rangers against Luton on Friday night. That's off tube for the EFL World Feed. I've got Bordeaux against Metz on Sunday for BT Sport. Then off to Qatar. And then on Boxing Day, I have the 12:30 kickoff, which is Wolves against Watford, which means a start of about 5:30 in the morning to drive up the M5 to get to Molineux. But I'm really looking forward to it because probably Mark will agree with this, but the one thing I love is doing Boxing Day football.
Yeah. Oh, happy Christmas. Get in a car at stupid o'clock on Boxing Day to go and cover a match. There's few things for me that are better than that. I couldn't agree more. Mark, it's lovely to see you after all this time. It's been a long time since we've actually been able to have a beer together. I mean, I saw John at Crystal Palace just the other week, and we were talking about Marillion. Inevitably comes every conversation when I see John because it is one of his particular favourites. But it's nice to know, frankly, the amount of time, just like my dear old Uncle Ian, who I was named after, who moved to San Francisco from Grangemouth in his 20s, he never lost his Scottish accent. Not a tinge of it, and nor have you. Although, I imagine when you go back to Edinburgh, they all think, what are you talking about that for?
Yeah, they do. And because I've got a Scottish wife, I think it helps. Our daughter is now 3. She's got an American accent. So I'm sure there's a Sheena Easton-esque twang that comes out. Whether it's when I do Darmstadt against St. Pauli from my wife's makeup desk from home on Saturday for ESPN+, Plus, or whether it's Sociedad against Valencia on Sunday afternoon from work, which is then followed by a mad dash to Newark Airport to get a flight to Heathrow, to get into London on Monday morning to attend Ipswich against Rotherham on Tuesday, and to launch Paul's book. But it's been a pleasure being on. And who would have thought, as I've mentioned, that had it not been for Pelé and Santos playing Plymouth in 1973 in the March, that the gate receipts of that were used by Paul Mariner. Who would have thought, huh? There you go. You can have that for free, but you have to read the rest of the book, Dance.
Yes, the book. Let's get the plug in. When's the book out? When is it actually on the shelves?
It's out now. I think the first copies were delivered to Ipswich today. This is the Thursday, but it's available online. And I think you get 40% discount right now. But just so many tales, and God bless you, Paul Mariner, wherever you are, up there watching down.
Get your previous work on Steve Nicol, the Hearts book about the trials and tribulations you went through under the foreign ownership, which are all part of your canon of, it's non-fiction, but you'd love to think it was fiction because the truth is more horrible than what fiction could ever throw up. And I'm speaking as a Birmingham fan with all the crap we've gone through in the last 10 years. Is there a book in you, finally, John?
There may be. I don't know whether anyone would actually be interested in reading it. I mean, several people have done their sort of life stories in journalism, haven't they? I mean, if I can recommend one, John Anderson's A Great Face for Radio is an absolutely marvellous book. If you've not read it, Mark, you really must. It's about the golden age of radio, when radio was absolutely superb, with commercial radio and BBC local radio both competing for audiences. I love that book. I'm not sure that anyone would be interested in a sort of mid-ranking football commentator who works for a different variety of clients. It's not as if I'm John Motson or Barry Davis or something. I mean, I've made a decent living out of being a squad member.
You're on this podcast. You're on.
Well,
this.
I've arrived at last.
The conduit to something way, way beyond what you could possibly have imagined. Well, what delight to have you both on, and it's nice to introduce you two to one another as well, seeing as you've not actually properly cross paths before. John, Mark, thank you so much.
Cheers, Dance. It's been a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
So my thanks to Mark Donaldson from ESPN and John Roder from Match of the Day for joining me on this episode of The Commentator's Curse. Hope you've enjoyed it. I certainly have. There'll be another episode along in due course with another couple of special guests from this weird old world of commentary. And of course, if you like this episode and this is the first one you've dipped into, there's previous 13 episodes for you to try with various great and good characters from the game of commentary. This is Ian Dancer signing off. Back next time then with another episode for you to enjoy of The Commentator's Curse.